Welcome to Let's Talk Legal, part of Coastal Daybreak every Tuesday morning and brought to you by Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. You can call in now to have your legal questions answered by attorneys Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. Call in now with your questions at 252-247-7282.
Glad to have you joining us here on the program. And again, your calls are welcome. And Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are indeed with us. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Morning, Ben.
All right, what are we talking about today?
Ben, the last few weeks, I think this is maybe our third week here, we've had Mr. Morris, Sam Morris, of our office, and of course Wes Collins, the lead partner at our office in the area of litigation, kind of carry us through, if you will, the nuts and bolts of the jury trial. And so we continue that today. We got through, where did we get last week, Wes?
Well, we picked a jury.
Right.
And we talked about opening statements, right, which we established is, you know, really just a forecast of the evidence, not argument. And I think we're to the point where we're actually putting on evidence now.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, somebody asked me a question after the show. Can an opening statement be construed as evidence or the presentation of evidence, or is it just the outline?
It's just the outline. You know, I don't know how the jury's going to construe it. I mean, obviously they're going to sit there and listen to you. And, you know, the books you read about this, about jury trials, the training that you get is, you know, that the jury's made up their mind during the opening statement anyway, without hearing any evidence.
Right.
So I don't know how much truth.
That's why they're important.
Very important. Now, a lot of prep goes into those. But my goodness, I mean, by the time you get to the point where you're ready to try a jury trial, doggone it, you're ready for an opening statement because you have lived and breathed that case for a long period of time. You've done a lot of prep work, and your opening statement is not the most difficult part of this, especially when you've done it many times before.
I think, though, to be technical, Ben, the judge, there are some jury instructions, Wes will correct me if I'm wrong, but about the fact that the opening statement of the lawyers and the closing statement of the lawyers in and of itself is not evidence.
Right.
Okay. Right. The common statement that I hear Wes say, I've attended a couple of his trials, you know, the evidence will show you. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you are going to hear the following evidence. And of course, that's classic opening statement language. And then of course, you know, in the closing argument, we're not there yet. Don't want to get there right now, but the bottom line is, as you saw or as you heard, the evidence was. So the closing arguments and the opening arguments are statements and arguments by the lawyers, but they are not in and of themselves evidence.
Yeah. So, but that opening statement, jury can use it to compare, did they actually do what they said they're going to do? You know,
no doubt about that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you tell the jury that the evidence is going to show this and that and this and that, and it doesn't show that, then you might lose a little credibility with them. So yeah, you need to don't overstate things in your opening statement. Yeah. So we're to the point where both the plaintiff's counsel and the defendant's counsel have made their opening statement, and now it's the plaintiff's turn to put on evidence. So the process of putting on evidence is done through witnesses. There could be stipulations as to certain things that do come into evidence. But typically you're putting on a witness, you know, you're going through the typical question process, state your name, address, where you're from, all those kind of things, establishing who they are and asking questions of the particular witness with regard to whatever the case is about to get into evidence, whatever, you know, evidence you need to get in. Of course, we've got to navigate around the rules of evidence. You know, we can't get into hearsay things. You know, we want more testimony based on personal knowledge, with some exceptions to the hearsay rule.
I mean,
you're navigating the rules of evidence. You know, in many cases, you're establishing what certain things are, like, you know, what is this document? What is that document? Sometimes your witnesses or experts might be a doctor, for example. So then we're getting into opinion. We're talking about the expert opinion of the person. How did the person appear? Did they appear to have their capacity at this point in time? Let's say if it's like a will caveat case and the issue is maybe they whether they had the capacity to enter a will. Or if it's a personal injury case, it could be more about what medical treatment did this person receive as a result of the accident.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know, so we're just going through all this. Now, at this point in time where the plaintiff is putting on evidence, you know, you can't just lead the witness along with questions.
Mm-hmm.
You can't suggest what the answer is going to be. You're not going to be asking questions like, you know, isn't it true, doctor, that this is
right.
the worst,
right.
you know, whatever.
Right.
Isn't it true that, no, you're going to ask the doctor, what are your opinions?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to ask the witness, maybe the fact witness, what happened next? You're going to ask the fact witness, what did you see? You know, they're very open-ended questions without a suggestion of an answer. And that's what you call a non-leading question.
Mm-hmm.
Leading questions are when we get to the cross-examination.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the defense counsel then has the opportunity to cross-examine the particular witness.
And may infer some things in their questioning.
No doubt. May impeach,
yeah.
May cross-examine to establish whatever they need to establish. So we're going through the process of putting on our case,
mm-hmm.
and this is very important. This is not plaintiff puts on some evidence, then defendant
right.
puts on some evidence. No, the plaintiff puts on all of his evidence
right.
during his case in chief.
Is there a rhythm to that? I mean, like, do you want to put in something that's just sort of baseline factual stuff first? Do you want to get people nodding their heads, or do you want to put in something that's a little bit more dramatic? You know, is there a rhythm to it?
Every case is different,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of thought goes into the order of the witnesses and what evidence is going to come in through each witness.
Mm-hmm.
How
to build the story?
How is the evidence and the testimony going to be perceived by the jury of 12 sitting there?
Mm-hmm.
You have to put yourself in their seat and recognize that they only know what they heard in jury selection and opening statement.
Mm-hmm.
They do not know as much about this case as Mr. Lawyer knows about it.
Right.
So you have to think about what do they know. And sometimes it's a little bit of a difficult thing because you've got to kind of depart mm-hmm. yourself from your familiarity with the case. And think about how this would be logical for them to understand, you know,
mm-hmm.
for example. So, yes, it's very important to consider the order of the witnesses. You know, sometimes you have, for example, video depositions. That's important. Those could be just as boring as can be, by the
mm-hmm.
way. I would
right.
say generally in with a video deposition that we play before a jury, I try to keep mine as short as possible.
Are you required to present the entire video deposition, or can you edit it down?
Okay, that's a great question. Because when you go do a video deposition, also referred to as a Debenese deposition, you don't have a judge sitting there
mm-hmm.
who's calling balls and strikes on objections.
Right.
So in many cases, the lawyers pretty much discuss prior to the deposition any areas that may be questionable from an evidentiary standpoint and maybe work that out.
Okay.
So they try to have a clean video.
Mm-hmm.
But in the event there are objections during the video, then in many cases, those objections are considered by the judge before the trial starts. And if the judge sustains the objection, then in many cases, you're turning the volume down so the jury does not hear that particular testimony during the trial.
Okay.
So you've got to work that issue out.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have the objection, but you just carry on. You know, you get the testimony. If you don't get the testimony in by asking the question, then you don't have it to present to the jury. So you go ahead and get the testimony and then wait on the judge's ruling for a later date.
So
good lawyers are going to try to work that out.
Right.
Both sides want a clean record.
Yeah. Right.
In most cases, unless
yeah.
you're dealing with someone who's
you actually
a little bit
just
of a
will
obstructionist.
Turn- Yeah. You actually just may turn the volume down.
Absolutely.
You don't edit it? Or
you can edit
uh-huh.
it, but the logistics of doing that
yeah, right.
are going to require a hearing on an evidentiary issue
yeah.
well
right.
before the trial,
uh-huh.
before the trial judge,
mm-hmm.
who may not even be in the area until the day of trial, and then getting it back to the editing people so
right.
they edit it. So sometimes those logistics don't work.
Yeah,
that's a great point as well. All these evidentiary issues normally take place on Monday morning
mm-hmm.
when you're about to try a case that week, and I'm talking about state court,
mm-hmm.
Superior court,
right?
That's the federal court really as well too.
Mm-hmm. So to that, the objection side of that,
mm-hmm.
Do you think that the jury with do they infer something from the number of objections that are made in a case?
I don't know. I try to limit mine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to appear as someone who's who's trying to obstruct mm-hmm. the evidence, but at the same time,
you can't let egregious things go by.
Yeah, you really want reliable evidence mm-hmm. to come before the jury. I mean, if you have an attorney who is objecting, and it appears as though they're objecting so much for purposes of trying to break up the flow of the other lawyer
yeah.
or to obstruct the flow of the case, I think that in many cases, the juries don't like that.
Right.
And in many cases, they begin to hurt themselves. You mm-hmm. get diminishing returns with these objections. So I think that that's something that, you know, I don't think a jury really appreciates that. So, but a reasonable objection, you know, with a discussion at the bench about whatever the issue will be and, you know, a proper ruling on that. I mean, that's all par for the course. That's, mm-hmm. that's normal. All right. So when you're putting on your case as plaintiff's counsel, you're putting on your whole case. And it's very important that you think about all the elements of whatever your claims are. Because if you fail to put on evidence of any particular mm-hmm. Element of a claim, then a directed verdict's coming. And what I mean by that is that once you put on all the evidence, you put on all your witnesses, you got all your exhibits in, and you have to, during the trial, you have to ask the court, Your Honor, I move to introduce into evidence this exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And by the way, the jury can't see these photographs or these papers or these bank records or any of these exhibits until they're in evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just identify it with the witness and then just say, publish it to the jury.
Right.
No, you got to get it in evidence.
Right.
And once it's in evidence, then you can ask for it to be published.
Okay. All right. We'll have more on that because the evidence side of that is always something that fascinates a lot of people, and especially if you've watched anything on TV, you see that as well. This is Coastal Daybreak and Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. You can find out more about them at harvellandcollins.com, including listening to past shows, and you can look them up by subject, and you go to harvellandcollins.com. Hey, welcome back here on a Coastal Daybreak and Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. We're talking about the procedure of a jury trial and a number of the events that take place. You're talking about putting on evidence.
Right. So we're on the plaintiff's side. We're putting on evidence. And, you know, keep in mind that this is not the time for the defendant mm-hmm. to be able to put on any evidence.
Right.
Now, the defendant may, for example, use a document to impeach someone
mm-hmm.
or may use a deposition transcript to impeach. To attack the credibility, the character, to attack the veracity, you know. So, but that defendant, in using these documents, doesn't put that into evidence.
Mm-hmm.
He may establish the authenticity of the documents, so on and so forth, and then it comes right into evidence during their case.
Do they challenge that at the time you're putting it into evidence, or does that come in their side of the case? If you're putting a document and they say this is not authentic signature, et cetera.
No, they object at that point in time.
Right.
But okay. Let's say that they have another document that they want. Let's say someone testifies they said something at some point in time, but they wrote a letter or an email that's inconsistent with that.
Right.
Well, the defense attorney may use that email or that letter
mm-hmm.
to impeach what the witness said during their direct testimony.
But during the time
on cross-examination.
Yeah, it would be on
okay. cross-examination.
Right. Gotcha.
Right. But the defense is not putting that into evidence.
Mm-hmm.
This is my exhibit one, my move into evidence. No, that's mm-hmm. not. You do that later.
Okay.
But so, you know, kind of moving through this,
mm-hmm.
we've got all our witnesses who've testified. We have all of our exhibits into evidence. We rest our case. Well, at that point in time, the defendant is almost certainly going to move for directed verdict.
Mm-hmm.
That's a standard thing. We're going to ask the judge to consider all the evidence that's come in thus far and make a determination as to whether there is enough evidence to support all of the claims that have been made.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this might be a lawsuit based on a certain set of facts that has five, six, ten, whatever different claims in it. And maybe there was evidence to support all five, six, or ten, or maybe there was evidence only to support three,
mm-hmm.
or maybe there was not enough evidence to support any of them. But this is not the judge substituting his or her opinion for the jury. This is the judge simply making a determination as to whether you have enough evidence to support your claims. Very low standard.
Mm-hmm.
Very low standard. So then once you're...
I mean, do you ever see it succeed?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the case I just tried in December, the other side, it was a case about a will caveat, a challenge, mm-hmm. and the other side put all their eggs in one basket, and mm-hmm. that basket being lack of capacity mm-hmm. to sign the will. Their evidence was more from like doctors,
mm-hmm.
those who were around at the time, you know, all this type of thing, people who knew the person. They also had a claim for undue influence, but they didn't put on any evidence about
right.
who unduly influenced, who, you know, affected this mm-hmm. person's decision with regard to the will. So on directed verdict, the court granted my motion as it relates to undue influence.
Okay.
So then the case was limited.
Okay, so it narrows the funnel.
It was limited going forward during my case mm-hmm. in chief at that point in time to deal with lack of capacity.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So then, you know, the defendant then has their opportunity to either put on no evidence if they don't want to,
mm-hmm.
and if sometimes they don't put on evidence because they want to have the last closing. If you don't put on any evidence, you get to close last. You get
okay.
to speak last
right.
to the jury. So you have to make that determination. And then if they decide to put on evidence, then they go through the same process that the plaintiff went through.
Mm-hmm.
Put on your exhibits, put on your witnesses through
same cross-examination process, et cetera.
Direct examination, mm-hmm. cross-examination, same thing. And then upon the close of the defendant's evidence, then there's, in many cases, a renewal
mm-hmm.
of the directed verdict.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important to do that for technical reasons I don't need to get into, but mm-hmm. it's a kind of a no-no to fail to do that, put
okay,
it that way.
Right.
So it's important to do that. So once all the evidence is in.
Now, is that the plaintiff putting on a directed verdict at that point?
No, it would be the defendant
okay. again.
Renewing my prior motion of directed verdict. Sometimes the judges deny it at the close of plaintiff's evidence, but
mm-hmm.
want to hear what the defendant has to say,
mm-hmm.
and then might grant it.
Okay.
At the close
gotcha.
Of all evidence.
All right.
Okay. And that preserves a right, basically, for the judge to grant a post-verdict relief.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't do that, you waive that right.
Okay.
So,
all right.
That's a little bit technical,
yeah.
but it's important to do that. Now, so we put on all our evidence with regard to this, and then we're to the point where we get to. Closing argument. But before you go to closing argument, you have what's called a charge conference.
Mm-hmm.
Charge conference is you communicate with the judge about what you think the jury instructions should be. This is pretty interesting, Ben, because in many claims that we have in North Carolina, we have pattern jury instructions.
Mm-hmm.
They're already prepared. Your typical negligence claims, a lot of your intentional torts like assault, battery, you know, stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
Trespass to chattels. I mean, you have very specific instructions that have already been prepared, so they're there in the book, and that's what they are. So you've
mm-hmm.
got the standard instructions, so the jury is given some instructions like Cecil was talking about, direction about what the closing is. It's not
mm-hmm.
evidence. But then you have the specific direction with regard to the law.
Mm-hmm.
What is the law? So... But in some cases, if it's a particular kind of case, a peculiar, maybe different type of case, then you don't have pattern instructions. So then you request of the judge special instructions based on rulings from the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And so the judges will take into consideration whether they will read those specific instructions to the jury.
Do the jury instructions also include like the range of award if they decided to award the defendant?
Nope. The jury makes their determination kind of in the blind about that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that you've got issue number one is liability. If you win on that, issue number two is damages.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's up to the lawyer to argue with regard to the damages. Now, there would be a jury instruction mm-hmm. upon what kind of damages you can give, but they're not going to be given numbers.
Okay.
Like this limit, that limit. But there are some limits, you know, mm-hmm. with regard to like punitives and these kind of things that are in our law. They're not going to have the actual numbers.
Okay. Right? Okay. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back again with our final thoughts here as we are presenting the evidence before the jury. We'll get to that coming up in a moment here on Coastal Daybreak and Let's Talk Legal. If you want to find out more about Harvell and Collins, you can call for that appointment, too, at 726-9050. Hey, welcome back here, Coastal Daybreak and the Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, and some finishing thoughts about our process here.
And Ben, this issue about jury trials gets a little bit boring. I'm going to try to move through
it
here.
No, it's good. That's me.
A lot of talking.
Yeah.
So, you know, with that being said, we just have 2-3 minutes left. So we've kind of worked through all the evidence now, and we're making our closing arguments. And 1 minute left.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You gave me the number one sign. So, we're making our closing arguments, and typically the defense is going to go first, and the plaintiff gets the last go unless the defense didn't put on any evidence.
Right.
Okay. So the plaintiff has an option if they want to go first and last,
mm-hmm.
but in many cases the plaintiff's attorney is going to waive that.
Mm-hmm. But they could have a rebuttal.
They could go first and last, but yeah. then if you go first, that gives the defense attorney an opportunity to rebut what the plaintiff's attorney said.
Right.
And if you just go last, I mean, the way I look at it,
right.
you go fresh,
yeah.
and they don't get to respond.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's the way I look at it. So then, you know, once you've completed your once you have completed your closing argument, then the judge then reads to the jury. It's very important that the judge reads it appropriately, correctly, clearly to the jury instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, I go ahead and start talking about those jury instructions pretty early on.
Right.
Because I know what I need to prove if I'm on the plaintiff's side.
Mm-hmm.
Or I know what the other side needs to prove if they're on the plaintiff's side. Obviously, I'm on the defense side. And if I think that they can't do it or I can, I'm going to let them know this is what you have to look for. And I ask them, are you going to follow that law?
Okay.
Okay. So,
all right.
We can wrap that up next week.
We're at the jury now, and we'll have more next week on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law.